everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You are listening to It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me today. My guest is Sheldon Krimsky, the Lenore Stern Professor of Humanities and Social Sciences and Adjunct Professor in Public Health and Community Medicine in the Department of Urban and Environmental Policy and Planning at Tufts University. He is the author, co-author, or editor of 16 books, including Science in the Private Interest and Stem Cell Dialogues. Today we're going to be talking about his latest book, GMOs Decoded. Thanks for joining me, Sheldon.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Let's start at the very beginning, the front of the book, the title, GMOs Decoded. I love it because I get it. Who came up with that title?
It was a collaborative effort. I had tried out a few titles, and MIT Press negotiated, and we worked out this title after some discussion.
Okay, it's actually, the full title is GMOs Decoded, A Skeptic's View of Genetically Modified Foods. Okay, for those who may not get it, let me just see if I got some of it. Our DNA, our chromosomes with the genes are fascinating and complicated, and we're slowly learning more and more about them, but they kind of operate like a computer. And what goes on with genetically modified organisms is kind of like coding, turning things on and off and making things happen or not happen. And then in addition, everybody is very confused and polarized about this subject, GMOs. And we hear a lot of people talking about the whole subject, and especially after reading your book, I realize how much people really don't know about genetically modified organisms, at least the science and how it works. So I like that title.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah.
Okay, so the beginning of the book is really very informative, and if anyone is interested in knowing more about genetically modified organisms, this is an excellent primer to understand the different things that are going on from a scientific point of view. And I thought we might talk about some of those things. And you also explain in good detail about traditional breeding and then this new, what do you call it? A micro?
Molecular breeding.
There you go. Yeah. Molecular breeding.
Molecular breeding.
And kind of maybe some things that come in the middle. Because some things that are considered traditional are maybe a little less natural than people might
absolutely,
like.
Absolutely.
Right. So can you touch on that a little bit? I know it's a complicated subject.
Well, the traditional breeding, of course, uses crops and hybridizes them when they can. But then in the early 20th century, people began to understand that you can create mutations in plant genomes by chemicals or radiation. And sometimes these mutations can have a beneficial effect for the farmer. So you can create these mutations by irradiating the seeds, the cells that are responsible for the plants. And then you can try them out and see whether or not they have the properties that you want.
It's kind of random, though, in a way.
That's pretty random. It takes a long time to see the effects of that. It's very inductive. You have to keep trying and trying and trying. There's no theory that guides it.
So the plants get, or the seeds get blasted, and then you plant them and see what properties each of them have, and then collect the plants that have the properties you like and keep like selecting and selecting.
So, yeah. For example, I had a graduate student who got her doctorate in plant genetics, and she spent many years trying to take the barley seeds and exposing them to chemotherapy agents, to mutations, to see whether the barley would resist herbicide, namely that it would be herbicide tolerant. And she kept doing this over and over and over again. Of course, these days they have robotics which can kind of make the process a little simpler. But she spent years trying to mutate the barley seed to see whether they would find one version of the seed which would be tolerant to the herbicide. That's the way that was done. And of course,
did she find one?
Yeah, she did, okay. And she graduated.
Okay.
And then she decided she didn't want to be in this field. So she got another master's degree in nutrition.
Okay, good. Good choice. I support that. Okay, so another thing that's interesting with traditional breeding versus this molecular breeding is you have a nice diagram, the taxonomy of living organisms in your book, where we can see how we're categorized, all living species, starting with life, domain, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. And most of the traditional breeding is done within the family, right? Changing the genus or playing with the genus or the species.
Yeah, the first two levels, really, within the same species or within the genera. Once you get beyond this second level, you can't use traditional breeding. Even at the genera level, you have to sometimes use enzymes to try to push the cells to accept some of the material from the thing you want to transfer it to.
So when some people say that there really is no difference with what we've been doing in terms of our food with traditional breeding and now we have molecular breeding, there really is a difference because now we're playing with things outside of the genus and the species.
Well, that's correct. And any good biologist would admit that this is a unique movement in biological history, that we're able to do this, just as recombinant DNA was an extraordinary advance in being able to cut and splice genes that would never have been cut and spliced in their natural habitat.
This book is about 150, 160 pages, and when I first got it, I thought, oh, I'm going to be able to read this really quickly, because normally I read very quickly, especially when it's about nutrition and food, because that's what I focus on a lot. But I'm going to tell you, it was not fast reading. And part of it is every field has their own language, and it's almost like learning a foreign language when you have to get comfortable with all the names and the vocabulary in order to go further and understand all the layered concepts. And so it took me more time than I had anticipated, but it was worth it. And so when we're talking about all the different types of molecular breeding, the one that I wanted to focus on, even before we get there, let's just clear up some vocabulary. Not everyone understands that we're all made up of cells, and inside the cell is where the chromosomes are. And correct me if I'm wrong. In the chromosome is where the DNA is, these spirally pieces of proteins. And then the DNA has little bits that are genes that make up all the characteristics of all of us. Is that close to
yeah.
right?
Yeah. The genes are not proteins themselves. They are ribonucleic acid. They're chemicals, nucleic acid. They are the templates for the construction of proteins. And the proteins themselves play an enormously important role in turning the genes on and off, in creating all kinds of pathways in the body. So the genes are critical in terms of the synthesis of the proteins within the cell. And the proteins are absolutely critical in all the aspects of our biological, events in our bodies and in plants.
So the molecular breeding process that I was most interested in is, what did you call it? The one with the promoter, the transgene, the marker gene, and the termination sequence.
Yeah, yeah. You create a complex of chemicals, including the gene, and then you have to have something else next to it to turn it on when it gets into the cell that you place it in. You have to have another piece of DNA that tells the plant genome, okay, stop here, you've done enough. You've synthesized the protein, now you can stop. It's called a stop gene or stop codon. And then you sometimes have almost always have a marker gene, which allows the scientist to determine whether or not the transplant, the genetic transplant, has taken. Because you have all of these cells in a big dish, and you've actually transported the genes you wanted to transport. Actually, it's a complex of genes, of DNA, into the cells. Some of them may not take. So if you have a marker, then what you can do is you can douse the cells with antibiotics, and the ones that survive are the ones that for which the transfer took, because you're putting in a marker that's antibiotic resistant. So it won't kill the cells that have that. So that's the way they can cull the ones that took the transplant.
It's fascinating. It's complicated. And we'll talk about whether we need to do this later or not. But I just want to understand what's going on. So when I started reading this and understanding it, I was getting a little hysterical. Nervously, anxiously hysterical, because I kept thinking the more pieces that are involved here, that means the more things that can go wrong.
Yes. Well, I think the one thing I try to emphasize in the book and in many of my talks is that the genome of whether it's plants or humans or animals is not a Lego system. In a Lego system, and most people understand what the Legos are, if you pull off one piece, the rest of the pieces are just going to be there. Or if you add one piece on, it's not going to disturb the rest of the structure. It'd be very unusual to destroy the whole structure with just taking out a piece or putting in a piece. But the genome, whether it's any biological species, is more like an ecosystem. So when you put in a gene, it could affect the other genes in the system. Or if you take out a gene, it could affect the other genes in the system. And we're learning more and more about how this ecosystem operates. So if you just add a gene, you say, well, it makes a protein. The protein is not harmful to humans. But the next question is, what else does it do? And there's only one way to know that, and that's really to investigate whether it has any other effects on the genome ecosystem.
In science, we're very much into reductionism, and it may not be intentional, but it's affordable and it's manageable. It's very hard to test interactions of many different variables. And it's easier to write a grant, let's say, for one particular thing and show that it goes up, it goes down, it does one thing or another in a controlled environment. But it's the interactions. We're starting to learn, or maybe relearn, in the medical field that our bodies, the head bone's connected to the everything's connected. And we have all these specialists for different organs. And we're learning now about the gut and how, in some ways, it's acting like a brain communicating with the entire body. So the reductionist approach can be dangerous.
Well, yes. I mean, it can be extraordinarily helpful.
Helpful or dangerous.
Because... You can create causal networks through reductionism, and you can eliminate complexity by looking at one path at a time. But when you're looking at the organism as a whole, usually it doesn't operate that way. Usually there are other interactions that occur. And the best example you can give is when a new drug is approved. Mm-hmm. It's approved because it can do something to the body. It can release an enzyme, or it can stop an enzyme from activating in your body. And you hope that when you've tested it on 1,000 people, that it has no adverse effects. But then you test it on 10 million people, and you find out that it has many adverse effects, because the genomes are so varied that there might be a different path that you haven't investigated. So yes, reductionism has its place, because it allows us to get information of a certain type. But you also have to ask what else in that system can be altered by the thing that you're studying, by the system that you're looking at.
I'm kind of jumping all around here, but there was one method, which I think is a traditional method, of forcing reluctant stigmas to accept alien pollen.
Yeah.
Now, that's in traditional.
It's in, considered, you know, traditional breeding. In a sense, this division, of course, is created by society. When we created sort of standards for, you know, bioengineered plants, somebody had to create a division. Well, certainly in Europe, where they have testing of any GMOs, they had to create a boundary between what is and what isn't a GMO. So, yes, there are things that you can do artificially to plants to get them to accept the pollen, or to get the plant cell to accept a foreign piece of material in it that would give you the property that you want. And all of these require human intervention. There is traditional breeding that requires very little human intervention, just by the flow of pollen that happens to flow into a plant that's receptive when you didn't do anything about it. But, you know, since the 1800s, 1700s, more and more of human interactions in plants have occurred. So there have been a lot of human interventions which help to propagate new plant varieties, still called traditional breeding.
Well, when I read that, it sounded like rape to me.
Well,
humans raping plants. You know, we exploit everything any way we can, and this was just one more thing.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, plants. I'm sorry what we did to you. Although then Michael Pollan would say the plants want us to do these things to us, right? Who knows? Okay, moving on. So let's talk about, I'm not going to pronounce it correctly, maybe I will, atumefaciens,
yeah,
the method to transfer disease to plants, but instead we're using it to transfer desired traits.
Yeah. So there's some, you know, viruses that can enter plants, and they're very effective at getting into the cells of plants. And there's two basic ways that the scientists have used to transmit the desired traits they want into plants. One way is through what's called ballistics, which is actually to take...
It doesn't sound good.
Ballistics. No, it doesn't sound good. So you take the genetic DNA sequences that you want to get into the cell, and you literally paint it on a small, tiny little particle, you know, a little, tiny little pellet ball, metal, and you have a gun that shoots it into the cells, and shoot these balls into the cell, and they deposit the DNA sequence into the cell, this mechanical cannon, you might say it's mm-hmm. called ballistics. So that's one way that it was done. And the second way was to attach the material you wanted to transmit into the cell onto a virus that is known, Agrobacterium tumefaciens, is a well-known and well-studied virus that enters the cell, and it empties its load into the cell, because that's what viruses do. So you attach it onto that, and you just contaminate the cells with that virus, and it'll drop off the DNA sequence into the cell, and it'll get into the chromosome, and then it'll do what you want the cell to do. So those are the two methods, yeah.
Yes, another violent-sounding method. It's clever, okay? Whoever figured it out was that clever.
No, yeah, very clever. You really have to understand plant genetics.
Yes.
Years of understanding.
And to use something that one would think would be negative and damaging,
yeah,
to use it for benefit.
Sure. I mean, supposing you wanted to get into a dangerous cult. Well, you might infiltrate somebody who looks cultish and enters the cult,
right,
and then does what that person wants to do,
very
gathers information.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I like that. Okay. Now, the policies in the United States are very different than in the European Union, as they are with many other countries. But you explained that in the United States, we are regulating things based on a product, and the European Union is looking at the process. And the results are very different when you do it that way. So why would the Europeans be looking at process and we look at product?
Well, first of all, there is a much higher awareness in Europe about what food technologies may or may not do. They went through mad cow disease. They went through some pretty serious problems with regard to food. So when genetically modified crops started to enter into the European Union, they began to look at and investigate what the risks were. And they believed that the process that was used to create these was unique, that you couldn't create some of these plants without a new technology that would enable you to transform the plant. And without understanding what the adverse consequences would be of this process, they figured you'd have to look at it case by case. They couldn't say overall that this process is going to yield safe outcome. So they decided to pass a law that said you had to test every genetically modified crop that entered the European Union. That was the law that they passed. And you had to label it. Because as in a drug, you know, you might ask your physician, how long have they had this drug on the market? And say, a week. You'd say, well, I'm going to wait a couple of years to see whether or not there are any adverse effects, you know. They wanted to see what the possibilities were. And they wanted to do some risk assessment testing. The United States, in 1992... the FDA reached its decision based upon an enormous amount of lobbying from the biotechnology industry, that they declared that genetically modified crops were as safe as traditionally bred crops. They didn't have evidence in the sense of empirical evidence because they'd never done any testing. It made a declaration. They called it equivalence. Mm-hmm. And they operated from there. And they said, well, if there's any danger, then the manufacturer would let us know if there's any danger. Or if the manufacturer has any questions, they can come to FDA and ask. They declared it substantial equivalence. And people thought, well, the government says it's substantially equivalent. They must have evidence.
All the testing,
they must have evidence for this. But no, they didn't have evidence. It was an a priori declaration.
I remember when that came out, and we were all thinking, at least the people in my circle, how could something be equivalent if it's supposed to give better yields or be more nutritious or resist insects? So it's the same, but it isn't the same. And
so here the government said it's the same in every other respect except that
it's better.
It's tolerant to herbicides, or it's tolerant to insecticides or whatever. Other than that, it's totally the same. And again, that's a very reductionist way of viewing it. Like it can only do one thing and nothing else.
What's really nice about your book is I feel like you try very hard not to appear biased, and that you're just presenting information. Occasionally, you've made a statement that I think might lead us in one direction, but in general, I'm not blown over by you trying to convince me of something other than presenting the information, which is really very helpful. I have not found that in other similar books, necessarily, by scientists presenting that kind of information. There's usually a preconceived conclusion.
From the beginning to the end. And I experienced these worlds that seemed like they didn't really have much to talk about. They chose their own evidence. They discarded the evidence that they didn't like. And they're living in parallel universes. And I thought, it's much more nuanced than that. These two worlds living apart. And that's what I tried to bridge, in a sense. I certainly never reached the conclusion that every genetically engineered crop is dangerous. As a matter of fact, there's no evidence that anybody has keeled over from genetically modified corn or soybean, which represents about 90% of the production in this country. And I also say, but that's only one part of it, because we've had 50 years of junk food, and nobody has keeled over, but yet it had a chronic effect on people, the nutritional effects of it. So I ask questions, well, could there be long-term effects that we're not aware of? Could there be nutritional components of this that create a decline in the value of the food? After all, they haven't been tested. And what about the tests that were done in Europe? And some of them have come out negative, that there were some adverse consequences. The one group of people don't want to hear anything about those tests. And other groups say, well, that's enough to convince me. So I went very, very deeply into that arena as well to see what I could learn.
Well, it's interesting reading because we're left with more questions and not necessarily specific answers because the studies haven't been done. We don't know all the answers. Some things appear one way. It's really hard to know. When it comes to nutrition, these long-term chronic effects are so hard to pinpoint. And there are numerous people, and my heart goes out to them, that are struggling with autoimmune diseases and are raising children in the autistic spectrum and are really struggling. And then some of them find tremendous relief and can even cure problems by changing their diet and their lifestyle. And they eliminate genetically modified foods, artificial colors and flavorings, processed foods, refined sugars and flours, and they may eliminate dairy and wheat. They may add more plants and less animal products, and they find tremendous benefit. Is it one of those things? Is it all of those things? We don't have the answers. So some of them will swear and say, I eliminated all genetically modified foods, I only buy organic, and I'm better now. Is this anecdotal? Or is this something we need to work on? We don't have those answers.
Right.
And sure, I would like our government kind of getting behind it and trying to find out, but that's not happening, is it? All right. There is the NASEM reports. Now, this is the National Academy of Science.
It has a long name.
Engineering and Medicine.
The National Academies of Sciences, mm-hmm. and Engineering and Medicine.
There you go.
NASEM.
Now, this is a nonprofit.
Yes, correct.
And they put, and I think you mentioned Lincoln was the one who started
it? Oh, yes. He started the National Academy. It went through several names, and its purpose was to provide objective scientific information to members of the government.
Yeah. And they put out annual reports.
Many reports.
And basically they've said that GMOs are safe.
Yes, basically they've said that.
So let me ask you, do you feel that they are influenced at all by corporate lobbyists or people that are promoting genetically modified foods in any way?
I have no direct evidence that the National Academy is influenced by any one single source. They are made up of prominent scientists. You have to be admitted to the National Academy. It's a prestigious position. But I would say, having read that 600-page report line by line, that there's a lot of nuance in the report. Even though they concluded that they see nothing about genetically modified food which would be unsafe. And they've been basically saying the same thing since the early 1980s. I list a bunch of reports that they've made in which they say that any kind of genetic exchange into the system, any recombinant DNA or plant, is not going to be harmful. A priori, which I don't quite understand, because we can make a harmful plant if we want to. So I don't see. But if you read the report very carefully, there are sections in the report which say it makes sense to test every new food. It makes sense. And when they went through the testing that was done mostly in Europe, they didn't like the animal tests. They were not happy with the animal tests, testing whole foods on animals, because there are all kinds of problems that occur. You have to make sure that your controls are proper, that you're giving both the controls and the test animals exactly the same type of food, except one is a GMO and one is the parental strain that's not GMO. And there are all kinds of ways that you could introduce bias into those tests. So they were not happy with it. So what they conclude is that in order to really understand whether your GMO is different than your non-GMO, you have to do what's called omics analysis. That's not a popular word. Basically, it means you have to test every chemical that comes out of that food and compare it with every chemical. Omics stands for proteomics, that is all the proteins. Metabolomics, all the metabolites.
Who does have
a background in chemistry, so you understand how complex that
who
is.
Who does that for anything?
Well, the fact is no regulatory agency does that.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a few people who have taken that and checked for a few omics tests on the GMO and the non-GMO. And some of them come up with differences and some of them don't. But no regulatory agency does that. So on one hand, they say, well, this is the gold standard. but we don't use it. So I found that kind of...
But everything's okay.
Very curious, yeah. But it's okay because there's no evidence. And the evidence that they used in the document was to look at overall cancer rates throughout the globe. So they'll look at the cancer rates in the United States, and then they'll look at the cancer rates at a European country that has brought in very few GMOs. And they'll say, well, the cancer rates here have gone up this much, the cancer rate, it doesn't look like there have been any changes in the cancer rates in these two countries. So therefore, GMOs are safe. Of course, cancer is just one
autoimmune disease?
One endpoint. It's just one endpoint.
What about depression? I mean, there's just so many different
things. Could be many different endpoints, including the lower nutritional value, which is not easily measured. Mm-hmm. Takes a long time to measure that. I've done some studies of the chemical industry. It takes between 25 and 50 years for our country to ban a dangerous chemical. PCBs, lead, asbestos. This taken between 25 and 50 years. Yeah. We have over 85,000 chemicals in our system. And we had a law that made it very easy to bring a chemical into the system and very difficult to remove it. So, again, it's very difficult to know whether there are going to be any other adverse effects. Again, understanding that each of these genomes of the crops is an ecosystem. What effect does the implant that you put into it, the genes from a foreign species, have on the other parts of the system? That's really the open question.
You also mentioned in highlighting some things from the 2016 ASEM report that some foods may vary like 30% in protein. And they say that it's not significant because food can vary in nutrition.
That's right. Sometimes when you look at a study done by a reputable group, they'll say, oh yeah, we did a study and we found that there was a statistical significance between the composition of the control and of the GMO. Oh, there's a statistical significance, but don't worry. Because if we look at all the plants that have grown, that it falls within the range of that significance. Well, who knows that? Where is that information? How is the public going to be assured? What if the plants that they've chosen to find this range are at the low end of the spectrum and we don't really use that much in our food? Maybe we're producing plants that are at the low edge of what we would consider good produce, but they're there. And maybe the GMO is giving us that kind of range. So anybody can say that. We don't see the evidence that it's there, and I found it very difficult to find that evidence. And this is another problem, because the FDA accepts studies by industry that are not in peer-reviewed journals. And I find that quite curious that...
Can you say that again?
Well, yeah.
They accept studies that haven't been peer-reviewed.
That's correct. So I'll give you an example. As you know, and your listeners probably know, there's a big controversy over glyphosate. Mm-hmm. Roundup is the trade name. And I was curious why the International Agency for Research on Cancer, IARC, part of the WHO, came up with the conclusion that glyphosate is a probable human carcinogen, and the EPA came up with the conclusion that it's not a human carcinogen, not even probably not. Mm-hmm. It's not a human. I say, here are these two agencies with experts. Why did they come up with different results. So I began delving into that. So one of the things I did was to look at all the evidence that they cited in their report, the EPA report versus the IARC report. And one of the things I found is that the IARC report would not accept any studies that were not peer-reviewed and published. EPA had 30 studies that came from companies that were not published. That's a good reason why they could come up with differences. Wow. So even though all of science is so supposedly universal,
pure and true,
yeah, one agency is willing to accept studies that have not been published and peer-reviewed because the companies claim it's the information is private and they don't want it in the public domain. So that's a reason why you can see differences in the studies.
Oh goodness, yes. Well, I'm going to lean more towards the European point of view, just because I like the idea of things being peer-reviewed and not hidden from the public. So on the same subject as of transparency, let's talk a little bit about labeling. And I was a bit confused when you were talking about the new regulations and what the federal government has decided versus what the states can and cannot do. It's confusing, isn't it?
Well, yes. The FDA has certain rights and responsibilities. States cannot approve or disapprove of a drug. But if the EPA approves of a chemical, a state can ban it, even though the EPA, in other words, the EPA does not have preemption rights over states on chemicals. But the FDA has preemption rights over states on drugs. So, you know, now, in the case of labeling GMOs, the FDA was the primary agency overseeing that. And the FDA said that there's no reason, no good reason to label GMOs because they're substantially equivalent. So they had substantial equivalence and therefore you don't need to label it. Well, there is, as many people know, a rule about organic food. And organic food cannot contain GMOs, according to the rule. There's a few other things it can contain. Irradiated food, you know, food from incinerator sludge, a few things like that. So if consumers want to be reasonably sure they're not getting a GMO, they can buy organic. So now, FDA, after a while, the states began to want to pass their own labeling. And close to a half a dozen states began to pass labeling laws. Vermont was furthest along, and it was ready to actually implement a labeling law. It won a court case that was taken against them by Monsanto and by the food, the food business. But they won that in the courts. So they were able to label it. So then the agribusiness decided it would be better to have our own labeling law so that we wouldn't allow the states to do it. And which is what they did. They had Congress pass a labeling law for GMOs. It has not yet been implemented. And it was passed a few years ago, actually. And the labeling law sounds very difficult. It may not just be a statement.
It may be a barcode, or it may be a telephone number where you can call up.
Right, which is so convenient for so many of us in the grocery store to want to make a phone call or pull out our phone and look at a barcode if we have a smartphone.
Yes, if we have a smartphone. So it was designed not to be that convenient. It certainly was. And we still don't know what the effect of that has been or is because it's not been implemented. But we do know it stopped all the states.
So Vermont isn't labeled.
Out. Because the federal law had in it a preemption. Once this law is passed, no state can pass a law. So the federal government can pass a law that preempts states from doing something.
Wow.
And it did in this law.
Now, I see sometimes products that say non-GMO soy or something like that. Is that okay?
It is okay. They have not been sued. As long as they don't say this is better or safer or healthier than a GMO, then they've been allowed to do that.
Well, wouldn't we feel a little more trust in these companies if they would just come out and say what they're doing?
Yeah.
I think
in
so.
The one of the chapters of the book, I talk about the first genetically modified tomato, where the company said, this is a genetically modified tomato. They were right up front. And it was a tomato that would have a very long shelf life. I tasted it. I brought it to my home. I had to import it from a different state because it was only marketed in two states at the time. And it didn't survive the commercial market.
But it didn't survive because it was supposed to stay firm in shipping, and it didn't stay as firm as they wanted.
It had a lot of problems with the shipping, even though you could presumably pick it red rather than green.
So you allow it to ripen on the vine, and it'll stay firm.
Yes, that's right. And when I did transport it to my home, it stayed firm. It was very firm for a long period of time. And I did have my students who were willing, I didn't force them, to try it and compare it with the farm-raised tomato, and they all were able to pick out the difference.
Ah,
it was a blind test.
Right.
They were all able to pick out the distance.
Well, and that doesn't really tell us anything either, because tomatoes from one area and tomatoes from another will taste different.
That's correct, yeah. And in this particular case, they didn't add anything new to the tomato. They just took a gene and twisted it around.
I was reading that, and it's just so fascinating what you can do.
What you can do. You can turn the gene around, and therefore it was not producing as much ethylene, which is the ripening of the tomato. So that's why when they pick the tomato green, they spray it with this ethylene so it would ripen when it finally gets to the supermarket.
Okay, I can talk about this all day because it's fascinating and your book is loaded with information. We have about 5 minutes left. So we've been focusing mostly on the safety of genetically modified foods, and I think my conclusion is we still don't know anything. Even though in the short term, nobody's dropping dead from eating genetically modified foods, we don't know, have an effect long term. We don't know what it's doing to our guts. We don't know. And either in our own generation or generationally, we don't know those things. Fine. The things that have always concerned me about genetically modified foods is a much bigger picture. Just like when we're talking about the body and how all the organs are connected, I think we need to look at the food system as a whole. And many people, including Nina Fedorov, who wrote Mendel in the Kitchen, who you mentioned in this book, in the beginning of her book, which came out 15 years ago, she talked about how genetically modified foods are necessary in order to feed the world and feed the hungry. And there are many people who are focused on food today, and they know that this is not true. The problem with food security has to do with poverty, politics, distribution. There are many different issues that are related. We right now could feed everyone and make everyone fat if we wanted to with the amount of food we have on this planet. And so the population's growing, and can we make even more food? And personally, I think we can. And I think we can with some really sensible organic practices, and we don't need genetically modified foods. And there are so many different issues with genetically modified foods where some very well-meaning smart scientists are creating things in labs for a seed that may work very well in Iowa, but when you bring it to southeastern Africa, it doesn't work. And there are many disconnects where the scientist is focusing on very specific attributes and they're not realizing what the people really need. They may need something drought tolerant. They may need something, I learned this from Tim Wise in his book, Eating Tomorrow, that they need it to be grindable. It needs to have a certain grindability. It also needs to have a certain storability in resisting insects. And the GMOs are like failing all over the world outside of the United States on all of these different parameters that they haven't even considered. So it's really a very big picture in terms of should we or shouldn't we be even focusing on this kind of science. What do you think, Sheldon?
Well, I think that food grown in different regions is going to be facing different soils, different temperatures, so many different factors. You mentioned water. You can't expect one seed to be good for every conceivable environment. That's why these farmers have been trying, testing and trying and seeing which ones work better. In the National Academy report, the 600-page report, they could find no general conclusion that GMOs were increasing productivity. Mm-hmm. I mean, there may be a pocket here or a pocket there, but then in the same country, it may have shown a decline in productivity for some people. So there are so many other factors that are responsible for productivity that you can't just say GMOs are going to do it. You have to remember that GMOs were not designed for productivity. They were designed for herbicide resistance. They were designed to make the production process easier for the farmer so they can pour more herbicide.
I want to jump in there because that's another problem with GMOs is that they are promoting a type of agriculture that we're learning is devastating to our soil. We have tremendous topsoil erosion and the water pollution and air pollution from the pesticides and herbicides, and we're using petrochemical fertilizers and we're causing global warming because of all the release of carbon into the atmosphere. That's not a sustainable method.
Well, destroying the soil's potential for giving the crops their appropriate nutrition and their appropriate is a valuable thing to think about. And biodiversity in seeds is also something desirable. This idea of one seed fits all. The Monsanto seed can be used all over the world to give us great food. It does not seem plausible at all, given that all of the production systems, the natural production systems, are all different. Why should one seed work in every single system? It doesn't make any sense. The other thing to remember is that when you eat a GMO, certainly herbicide-tolerant GMOs, you're also consuming the herbicide.
Yummy.
It traces of the herbicide are on the food, and they enter the human body, and we now have the herbicides in our bodies, and we have no idea what the long-term effects. I mean, we have these big lawsuits of people who were exposed to large amounts of it. But we don't know what the chronic effects are of small doses of the herbicides over a period of your lifetime. So that's just another factor.
And there are so many. And we're going to have to end it right there. I can't believe we're out of time. But Sheldon Krimsky, thank you so much for joining me today on It's All About Food. And I really highly recommend reading GMOs Decoded, A Skeptic's View of Genetically Modified Food. You're going to need to digest it slowly because there's a lot of good stuff in there. Thanks for listening, and have a delicious week.